Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had to taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, 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 oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone, thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh, oh.
People who, like the founder of the show, recognize if they are on a dangerous path and make a difficult adjustment to become an amazing person. Share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength. Capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulders. Deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. This is part sinner, part saint, part of Late Night Poets on allpoetry.com. You don't have to be in Late Night Poets to participate, but it's more fun if you are. You can talk with us in the chat and read the poems as we do. I'm Afaziana, and normally Babbler is my co-host, but unfortunately she is away, hopefully having fun. And tonight I am joined by Robert. Hello, Robert.
Hello. You're going to have to settle for me. Sorry, guys.
Not settling. I just love Babbler, but it's all right. It's going to be fun.
Babbler's awesome.
It's good to have you.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I mean, I do like the topic of the show because as you express, you know, we're not all saints and we're not all sinners, but we're a lot of in between. So, yeah, it's nice.
Yes, we are definitely a mix of things. And that's sort of our prompt for tonight, too. The quote was, "You don't have to choose between your sexual side, your intellectual side, your emotional side, or your spiritual side. Just combine them all into one powerful expression and shine that brilliant light all across this world and beyond." So you have to pick one of your sides. You can be a little bit of everything. And I couldn't find who said that. It was just an image that I found. So if anyone knows who it is, let me know, and I will add that to the contest, give them credit. We do have a couple of carryovers from last week's contest, so we will start with those. And last week's contest was, "The vices come as passengers. Visit us as guests and stay as masters." So we're going to start with the responses to that. And let's see. Here's one. Would you read that for us, Robert? I just put one in the chat.
Okay, I'll give it a whirl. So this is "Home Invasion" by Ultra Gen. They arrive to the front door, knock and wait. Temptation stands with samples to share. Let them in so they can turn you on. They make themselves at home, settle and shift. Experimentation courts you with treasure to consume. Let them linger so they can suck you in. They chain themselves to you, feed and enslave. Addiction leeches you with force and permanence. Let them root so they can take you over." And boom.
Thank you for that read. And great poem, Ultra Chan. I really liked the personification of the vices. I thought that worked well with the prompt. I especially liked "experimentation courts you with treasure to consume." That it's courting you, it's seducing you, it's trying to, win you over. And then it turns out to be a trap. And I think leeches is a really good verb for what addiction would do, because it sucks all the energy and the willpower and like all of the good things out of your life, and that just seems like a really good way of describing it. So excellent word choice. What did you think, Robert?
Yeah, I agree. Leeches. Like, it's a basic word, but it's a very powerful, way of describing the process in which something is removed. You know, it's not just taken. It's like slowly drained from you, you know. And I really like the part that says, "Temptation stands with samples to share." So basically, whatever you need, they got your poison and you can pick it, you know. And it's not just I like the fact that he called it "home invasion," but it's people trying to sell you stuff or something like that, you know, or something that even you order that, you know, they have samples. So it's like, oh, let me get one of those, you know. And so this is a really interesting way. Like, he kind of makes them out to be like parasites, the people that sell you these things. And I thought he did a really great job in iterating that. That was very clever indeed. I liked it.
Our next poem to the same prompt is by S. Sharp. "Riding to the End of the Line" by S. Sharp. "The train runs underground along old tracks in dank tunnels. The light strikes into the car periodically, predictably, as the faces of addiction flash, then disappear, flash, then disappear. The train ambles along, clacking at each rail junction, passing every stop. Clack, 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 clack. The faces on the train are grim. They look hopeless, aimless passengers with nowhere to go. Clack, 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 clack. The light strikes into the car, it seems. Every face is mine." And poem.
can. Wow, that's a very interesting interpretation and the way that they formed it and put it into the metaphor of being a train and then seeing all these faces, but all the faces end up being you, you know, and whether it be in different stages of the addiction or, different addictions themselves, because people sometimes have many vices. And, that's a very, very interesting way. And it's very easy to see and to be able to relate to. And it's a very simple analogy. And with the clack-clack, you know, that kind of gave a lot of environmental effect to it. I thought this was great. They did a fantastic job in conveying the faces of addiction.
I really liked it, too. I think the onomatopoeia of the clack-clack really added to the effect, as you can imagine that it has that motion to it. When I was visualizing it, and I could be totally wrong, at first I was thinking, like, you're on the train, and you're looking out, and in a lot of, like, I don't actually live somewhere where there's a subway, but the way that I picture it based on, like, movies and things, that in those kind of subway stations or rail stations, there is generally homeless people hanging out in the area where you wait for the trains. So they're looking at that at first, and then it's showing the inside of the train at the commuters and looking at them and their kind of, like, bored faces as they reluctantly go off to work. And maybe their addiction isn't to the substances and the things that led to the troubles of the people who you see at first, but instead it's that addiction to, like, to money and to just capitalism in general, just kind of like, we're going to work so we can have the things, and that kind of apathy that you see sometimes in that public transportation. I do take the bus a lot, and you see both extremes for sure. And either way, it tends to be kind of like blank faces in transportation situations as people just kind of gaze off and pretend they're not in the situation that they are. So that idea of using the train to express it, I think really works well, even though it's not, you know, really about a train. I think from the train, you can see two different perspectives. And then the light strikes and you realize that it's you. And while everyone has different addictions, like you said, usually, like, pretty much anyone has something that they cling to. I mean, for me, it's food, probably. But everyone has something, and you can see yourself in any of these people too. Whether it's different circumstances for you, you know, they've made mistakes that likely you have to a certain extent, and being able to recognize that is the first step, I guess. Even though it says to the end of the line, I hope that you can get off the train.
Indeed. Yeah, that was a good analogy. I mean, a good analysis, I'm sorry. I didn't think of it. Yeah, like, because I've been on a train before over here, and it goes into the mountains and the tunnels and stuff, and sometimes the light's completely gone, and then comes back and goes and comes. And so it really put me in that situation. So that was good. That was a good setup they did there.
It is. I mean, freight trains go right by my work, but we don't have passenger trains, which is a little bit sad because, I don't know, like, definitely where I grew up, there were kind of passenger things. There was the Agawa tour train, which was like a touristy thing, but you can go up into the hills and kind of, like, see the fall leaves, and it was really pretty. But I don't know. For some reason, we don't have that here. The mountains are probably too hard to navigate in.
Probably, yeah.
All right, the next one is by Blue Leader 1. Can you read that one, please?
Okay. This is WIP by Blue Leader One. I'm sitting cross-legged on the floor, cutting myself with a razor blade because I want to feel. It hurts so sweet, I lick my fingers with it. When I was a child, my parents gave me a stone so hard and heavy it crushed my soul. The horror of it haunts me through time. Sometimes I bang my head on stone walls. At times I punch them with my fist. 400 blows are not enough. The new world man shares his poisons with me. They saved me, even as they were killing me. I needed them. I would have gone mad. I feel a furious anger in my heart. Can you feel my pain? Bastards. Sometimes when I sleep, I find some peace. And I think if I should die before I wake, what dreamless state awaits my fate? End poem.
Oh, wow. That is a powerful piece. You know, it starts off, you know, telling you how serious it's going to be because there's the cutting. I have some experience with that, and I know people who don't, generally don't understand it, but wanting to feel is a big part of it. And I like that the metaphor of my parents gave me a stone so hard and heavy it crushed my soul. So they gave a weight, and we don't necessarily know what that weight is. It could have been abuse of many kinds. It could have been, you know, even just passing on generational trauma. There is a weight that they've had since childhood weighing them down. And there's still that horror. So, like, it sounds like complex post-traumatic stress kind of thing where either one big thing or a whole bunch of little things in their youth have held them back. And bang my head on stone walls, that idea that, like, you know, you keep being self-destructive and, you know, probably self-sabotaging as you go through life weighed down by this trauma, and you try to fight every situation and it ends up, you know, hurting yourself. The way that New World Man is capitalized kind of makes me wonder about exactly what it's referring to. But shared his poisons makes me think it's sort of like it would be medicine, but they saved me even as they were killing me. It could either be prescription drugs that kind of mess with you, but that's how I was surviving, or it could be like street drugs that, you know, saved them from having to think about things, that escapism, but also destroyed them. Because addiction generally is not so much about the substance, it's about filling that void or blocking something out. There's usually a starting point that's not just, I'm going to have fun. It's a survival. It's a coping mechanism. And that when they say they saved me, that's what I think about is like a coping mechanism. And I like the way that some lines are shorter because like bastards just needs to be by itself because it's just like that pause and just think about it, bastards. I'm glad that's not just mixed in within a big line. And what dreamless state awaits my fate? It's a powerful one. It really makes you feel and think. So thank you, Blue Leader One, for sharing. What did you think, Robert?
Yeah, this hits real close to home. I can relate to this on many levels, and I also know people like I knew someone who they had things wrong with them in their mind, and they didn't take medication, but they didn't want to because they said that it made them worse, and they would slam their head into the wall to kind of either like stop, like get to try to get it to stop, whatever it was. And of course that wasn't healthy. And you know, they tried to do it to either get to knock something loose or to go to sleep or whatever it was that they did. It was not a pleasant sight. So I can understand that on a personal level. And as for the cutting, yes, I can attest to that too. So this really awakened in me a sense of bitter nostalgia, not the kind of nostalgia that's pleasant, but the way that they incorporated, like you said, the New World Man shared his poison. It kind of reminds me of like the Native Americans when they had their own like alchemy, you know, they had their own salves and potions and things like that, or rituals or whatever may have you they had. And then, you know, the other people come over and they, you know, spread their diseases and offer medicines that don't work, you know. So it kind of reminded me of that. And I know that's a little off tangent, but it could be, you never know. But yeah, I thought of it as like the pharmaceutical company. But yeah, you mentioning that it could be just like drug dealers or narcotics or anything, like anything of that nature that could be considered a poison. Yeah, that's a very thought-provoking piece. And yes, I agree too with the whole bastard. You know, like some of it is just like it just needs its own space, you know. You know, he questions the effectiveness of the drugs, and he also questions, like, basically, like, can you feel my pain? Like, do you understand what I'm going through? You know, and they don't. You know, they're just trying to make a profit, and whatever it may be, the pharmaceutical company or the drug company. But and then when I was a child, my parents gave me a stone. You touched on that in the. What I really thought of when you were saying it was the hereditary like the trauma of something in the family, you know, like you were born with burden and the stone was your burden to carry. So this is, I don't know, this just incited a lot of emotion in me and a lot of inner reflection. So I always appreciate when a poem can do that, and they did a great job with this. So thanks for posting that.
I agree with your theory for the New World Man that it could be about like the colonial aspect of, you know, Europeans came over and had different medicine that was kind of imposed on people who had their own ways that worked for them, and now here are these outsiders forcing themselves and you know, while Western medicine definitely has benefits that have saved me, it is something that the New World Man could represent that. And then talking about like the stone that's been passed on by the parents, I read this book a long time ago. It was called It Didn't Start With You, and it was about how like things that happen in to your grandparents influence you, partly because of the way that they treat your parents and then how your parents treat you, but also apparently if a woman experiences trauma, then her eggs get imprinted with a certain, like, something about the stress levels mess up the eggs, and so when she has children, they have that like already within them, and you can pass along issues that are like in your genetics from having traumatic experiences. You're more likely to have autoimmune disease. So it's like I can't explain it because I'm not a scientist, but it was like a scientific study that showed trauma actually literally gets passed down.
Yeah.
Fascinating and tragic at the same time.
I agree. Yeah, that I heard something about that the other day, actually. I was like, wow, that explains a lot, because, you know, they say depression is not just hereditary, but it's like it's almost like imprinted within person to person. So depending on your lineage or whatever. So yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. We're just all messed up more each generation, I guess, as we pass.
Yeah. Like a cascade of terrible.
Oh, all right. That's my optimism. we are now on to today's prompt. Those were all the carryovers. So I will reiterate the prompt just because if anyone has memory like I do where it just pops right out of your head. Today's prompt is, you don't have to choose between your sexual side, your intellectual side, your emotional side, or your spiritual side. Just combine them all into one powerful expression and shine that brilliant light all across this world and beyond. So our first entry in that contest is by Orence, and I will read that. It's called Snow Geese by Orence. So what if your one value is not half of the third of the quarter of what you thought it to be? The moon tears itself apart every night. The earth's dust rises as dawn settles all at once. On distances so vast, imagination can't fully embrace the whole heart of the land. The oceans advance and retreat everywhere. Some things have no price. We all know instinctively what those are. We'll still try to buy them. Maybe that's why we're doomed from the start. Crisp, clean air moves overhead, fresh and full with a flapping, flurry snow geese pulled along by the clouds, true north and true south calling them. We do not have a compass in our bones like they do, but we can watch them waxing and waning, reflecting brilliance of great shining bodies, and learn, aligned in organic harmony. They know the power of intangible things, lifting you up and making you whole. They know how truly priceless their own life is. And Paul.
Before we comment, I think we have a caller on hold and maybe Miss Frost.
We do.
Hi.
Victoria.
Hello, Miss Frost.
Hello.
Hi, how are you guys?
Oh, doing good here.
Good. Even better now that you're here.
Yeah, buddy.
I thought I'd come and hang out. It's been too long.
Yes. It's been way too long. I was listening to your song last night, like, a whole bunch of times as I'm getting ready to judge the contest, and my husband comes in and he's like, is that Victoria I hear?
Oh, no. You know, it's kind of funny because I commented on one of the other songs, and they were like, you know, I've heard about you. I've never interacted with you. And I'm like, crap, what is going on?
All right. So I will comment on this piece, right?
Please do.
Okay. So, first of all, you know, as I've said before, I do like nature pieces. And she basically made, like, the geese, I believe. Is it geese? Let me see. She says, crisp, clean air moves overhead, fresh and full with flapping fury, snow geese pulled along by the clouds, true north and true south calling them. So she basically made them kind of like the catalyst for the poem. And I like the fact that, like, her using all of these things that is within nature, like basically, like, they're magnetized to the pole, like they know where to go. It's all like, it's inherent in them, you know? And I think what a lot of that, it means it's like starts from the beginning. So what if your one value is not half of the third of the quarter of what you thought it to be? The moon tears itself apart every night. So, you know, even though, you know, the moon is ever changing and things like that, and it's only a fraction of it is visible, it doesn't make your worth any less, basically. So I thought that was a really interesting way of putting that. And then incorporating the whole nature aspect with the geese, and that we do not have a compass in our bones like they do, and then the organic harmony. I really like her phrasing, like the way that she incorporated that in there. I thought it was a beautiful piece. So yeah.
agree. It was beautiful. And I love the section about the moon in the beginning, about how its shape may seem like it's less. You may think you're only a third of a quarter, but you're more than you know. And, I mean, that's the cool thing about the moon is even when it's only a half moon, the whole moon is there. It's only part of it is visible, and there's more to us than people realize. I think that's a really gorgeous metaphor. And that kind of instinctual knowledge that she's talking about with the geese is a beautiful concept. Although, again, humans have messed with it in real life because by feeding the geese, we've made them not fly south. And now there are some generations of geese who have never flown south and are very confused by things. So we've messed with it. Oh, no. But that instinct that they're still born with of wanting to go and knowing that there's something about that and being able to find their way home. And, you know, humans have become disconnected from that in many ways, but maybe letting ourselves reconnect with that is a positive thing. I don't, she worded it so beautifully. And there's quite the alliteration in there, too. Fresh and full with flappy flurry. Lots of fun Fs in there. Victoria, what were your thoughts?
So I think that there's, and maybe I'm just reading into things, but fun fact is that snow geese have phases like the moon. They have their white phase and they have their blue phase, kind of like a new moon and a blue moon. But what I think is really clever about this is kind of what you guys were saying too, is that nature has this beautiful rhythm to it. And we as humans also have, you know, we have our circadian rhythm that doesn't always function the way it's supposed to be. And we've complicated our lives by removing ourselves from nature. We are of nature, but we are not in nature. And when we are in nature, we return to that circadian rhythm. We return to that kind of alignment. I think of going camping. So I went camping this last summer with my little family. And when the sun goes down, the kids went down. And when the sun got up, the kids got up. And it was just this natural rhythm of life that you fall into when you don't have those distractions. But we as humans have done a great job of removing ourselves from that place with distractions. We have the interwebs where if you get bored, you can go and watch a movie or you can watch a TikTok or you can go spend some money. And we have lost the value of life to some extent because we look to fill our time, which often ends up being meaningless, which is kind of funny because one of the ways that I teach financial literacy to some of my clients is that I say that, I just spaced it. It's a quote that I love. We don't spend money on things. We spend the time of our lives because you've given up hours to be for a set dollar amount. And when you spend that dollar amount, if you think of it in the terms of like how much you make. So if you make $35 an hour, obviously in your own currencies, but if you made $35 an hour and you go out to a dinner that costs $30, you gave about an hour of your life to eat at that restaurant. And a lot of times we don't think about that, you know, time value of money as much as the time value of our life. And so this really makes me think of that, the way that nature is still so ingrained with itself. It still continues on, even though we're the dominant species. It continues on without us. It continues in its own rhythm. No matter what we try, we are unable to disrupt that. And yet, we sit there and we watch it and we think of how nice it is that those creatures have this beauty, this balance, all while we go about our own rhythm outside of nature, that in many ways kind of destroys it too. And so I think there's a beautiful reverence in this, the recognizing of the rhythm, the recognizing of the phases, even the way that we have removed ourselves from it by going and buying meaningless things. to me, it's a call to kind of recenter yourself, to focus on what in life adds value, which is not always those tangible things, and to maybe even ground ourselves in the moment, because I think with the way our species works and operates, sometimes we forget to live in that present moment, and we tend to worry about all the things that we can't control. Yet here are these beautiful geese, content because they don't have any thoughts of what that might be. So I think it's a really beautiful piece, but I think it's really philosophical in many ways. And I think that she showed that connectivity that we've removed ourselves from in multiple ways, the phases of the moon, the phases of the geese, the compass of the times of the year and the migration. So really, really quite a stunning intellectual rite.
Well said. Victoria, I'm going to put you to work as a reader. There's one by Doc Frank that I posted.
All right. This is Lived Life of First, Gold to Bronze, edited, Doc Frank. Intelligence can be measured by IQ tests, pen poems, solving complex problems, doing many other things decided, use our life of first for your assessment, tested in many dimensions, situations, industries. GE engineers on Atlas rocket took first man to moon, cornering first worldwide fiber optic product. Imagine intensifier. Led Latin American sales organizations from second last to second first corporate director technology development. Improved R&D. Turned two businesses around, one as GM, before leaving for IBO. Negotiated first Arbok, Bell South, multi-year cable contract president of turnaround. Done in 2 years working 24/7 to failing stress tests. Doc said, do something else to live. Wow. Got PhD at 54 to become assistant dean, chair marketing department, Everett U. Found my passion teaching, using experience to support text concepts while studying. Started own management consulting company with four academics, only Everett professor, student nominated, to who's who 6 years in row retired. Still only score email counselor helping startups in all 50 states. Wrote book on American skill gap, first self-help genre, second book here. 44 years, 16 positions, 7 careers, enjoying 4 children's families, 10 grandkids, 2 great, and now learning to be a poet. Last 19 months, 5,000 poems, 2,300 awards, 130 golds, 17 front page picks, 13 auto ranks of 10-10 or better, 5 of 12.2 or 12.0 in full.
That's quite the resume. And
that's what I was reading.
It's like his resume of experience, and including his family and poetry accomplishments. And yes, in definitely impressive accomplishments. Wow. The first part made me go off in a different direction mentally, because it's talking about how intelligence can be measured, and I've always kind of questioned that, because after my brain injury, I was feeling so stupid, like, because I think way slower than before, much, much slower, and it takes me forever to process things. So I said to my doctor, I'm like, I'm stupid now. I need you to like figure out exactly how disabled I am. So I went for some IQ tests and they were like, you score well above average. And I'm like, for brain damage people? And they're like, no, just in general. And I'm like, that's not possible. I can't function in my everyday life. And they're like, yeah. I'm like, okay. I don't think that's accurate. So I don't know what they measure, but I don't know, that first stanza just made me think about that when I was like, how did I pass this at all? But I don't know how that that stuff can be measured. But I like pen poems solving complex problems. It's like the fact that there's no punctuation between that, it makes me wonder if the poetry is solving the complex problems. Here's my broken brain working its magic. I really like the way that that contemplates things in a different way, because generally solving problems tends to be more of like scientific method or like you know, more tangible things than poetry. But I love the idea of poetry solving problems because I think it can in some ways. This is really interesting look into Doc Frank. Robert, what were your thoughts?
I'm glad that you pointed out the whole intelligence factor. That's where my mind was stuck at as well, because over time, I felt that like I keep referring to my brain as mashed potatoes with the occasional sprinkle of gravy. But, you know, that's what I feel like. And then I haven't, you know, measured in quotations my IQ in a while, but it really feels like as over the years, due to certain things and traumas and whatnot, that I don't feel that anymore, like how you were saying. Although a lot of people say other things, it really got me thinking too, put it that way. Anyways, so in this, yeah, he was displaying his accomplishments and, you know, saying that even in some aspects that his accomplishments didn't seem like it would be enough, but at the end that he had what mattered for the most part, like his family, grandchildren, and then he had his poetry, which he was, you know, new to, and he's embraced it, and he's reaping the rewards from that. And those medals and treasures and gold seem very important to him as well, like as if they kind of sated his appetite for accomplishment, and which is a good thing, because poetry, as you said too, can fix problems. And yes, problem is a frustrating word in itself, but it is a problem. But it helped me a lot when I was younger. It was very therapeutic, like to be able to get a lot of these feelings out in some manner, because they were just boiling and boiling inside me. Of course, after a while, even that wasn't enough, but that's another story. In any case, yeah, he touched on a lot of interesting and humanistic topics in here. And I would tell him that you're hired because of, you know, what is such a wonderful resume. But yeah.
Yes, it would be hard not to hire him. Victoria, what are your thoughts?
So, yeah, this does read a lot like a resume. Truth be told, it kind of threw me because I think that there's a lot of times where people can have imposter syndrome. In fact, you did a contest on imposter syndrome, Faze, and this does not feel like someone who thinks they have imposter syndrome. And I won't lie, I grew up in a family who is highly intelligent and they know it. And I don't do well with these kind of self accolades. I mean, if we want to start naming off all the fun successes, I have a cousin who's a nuclear physicist and rocket scientist who developed a way to recycle nuclear water. Woohoo! It doesn't mean anything. you know, I'm about to be a partner in my own firm, which makes fairly significant money. It doesn't mean anything. To me, these are a lot of professional accomplishments that I don't know are anything that's really when you die, they don't go with you. You know, the things that people remember you for may or may not be the things that you pride. But what I do really like about this is that it, to me, speaks of pushing yourself to try to do your best. You have the ability to go as far as you allow yourself to. And like both of you, I come from a very intelligent family, but I won't lie because I don't participate in that. There's definitely times where I sit there and I'm like, I don't pay as close attention to my spelling anymore because the computer does it for me. So have I lost something? Have I become deficient in some way? Because like any other muscle, you don't use it. To me, speaks of the desire to keep pushing yourself, to keep trying, to never let there be a reason for you to stop. That's how I'm going to choose to take it. To me, it also speaks of someone who may be struggling with perhaps even some accomplishments that they didn't do, because we have a lot of wow kind of moments, or excuse me, I'm getting over a sinus infection. There's a lot of wow kind of moments, and there's a lot of, you know, oh, that's an amazing thing to do. I wish I could do that. And I half wonder if there's also moments, because there's a mentioning of 4 children's families and 10 great-grandkids and 10 grandkids and 2 great-grandkids, but none of the accolades are around his family. It is all around his careers. And so part of me wonders if this is also a commentary on if you fill your life full of achievements that won't really be remembered, is it worth it? Because I highly doubt the great grandkids or the grandkids or even the kids are going to talk about, oh yeah, Dad wrote a self-help book. So I think that this is kind of a complex poem to comment on because it really does read like a resume. And it's a good resume depending on the job. But it also makes me wonder in all this year of first, in all this life of first, what first were also missed. So interesting read.
I'm intrigued by that thought. Because it's true, you could miss a lot of the firsts of your family. Oh, I feel like that's a whole other poem possibility. All right. This is the thing. Whenever I read a poem or I hear someone's interpretation of a poem, generally it makes me want to go write something else. Of course, then I get lost in this cycle of ideas and I don't end up doing anything because I have, like, too many, and I'm just like, well, now I can't decide what to do. Because I'm smart like that.
Yes.
Speaking of which, I just posted 2 poems, and so we're going to have to go with the first one I posted. I scrapped and scribbled because I got carried away. Robert, would you please read the one by Scraps and Scribbles?
I will try. So this is just called Poem by Scraps and Scribbles. The little grains of sand and all the stars, the atoms that vibrate and make a man, the mother blue of earth, the rust of Mars, the spread of eyes that paint a peacock's fan, the petrol puddle of a beetle's back, the sinew soft and sultry sail of snake, the word that overcame the cold attack, the scoring work of golden leaves and rake, the scatter black of birds against the gray, the way the moody wind will kick the sea, the kiss of gold between the night and day, the momentary madness of the free. It's all of this and indefinite and infinitely more that fill the dreaming darkness at my core. End poem.
Excellent read. And that is absolutely beautiful poem. I could imagine with like incredible vibrancy the colors that it was talking about. Like so many images came to my mind. I really like that when it's talking about the peacock's feathers, it's the spread of eyes because it does have that eye pattern on the feather, those gorgeous feathers. And the idea of it's like the spread of eyes, it's like all of a sudden they're all looking at you when that tail opens, is just creates an image. And even that it's the rust of Mars, like not the red of Mars, the rust. It's a very specific tone. And the petrol puddle of the beetle's back is a really great way to put it, because there is that kind of where, depending on the light, it seems to move what color it is. And that's just like if there's a puddle of gasoline, there's this certain way that the colors mix together. That's really intriguing. And for that to happen naturally in nature is just like an amazing thing. So to refer to the beetle as a petrol puddle, it just, it's very, I can't even think of the word, but it hits me in the face in a really good way. And when it's talking about blackbirds against the gray sky, the scattering of them, it's not just that they're flying or gliding. That moment when all the birds scatter, if there's a noise or even just some like kind of like unknown signal to us, all of a sudden all the birds take off at the same time. And there's something really powerful about those moments that always makes me wonder, like, what made them fly like that? And they go in such amazing unison. And then to personify the wind as moody, as it kicks the sea, every bit of this makes me want to paint. And I am not a visual artist. I wish that I was. But I feel like every line in this could be an image, because it creates an image in my mind. And it's almost like a flip book as you quickly go through these images, and then you realize that all of that is a part of who this person is in some way, that each of those images represent a part of them. So, I just thought this was a powerful kick of a poem. Victoria, how did you feel?
So I am a stickler. I there's been more than a few contests where I have warned that if you're going to rhyme, do it well. I think we all start off in poetry kind of doing those really cliche rhymes. I distinctly remember being 8 and being like hug and bug, and that's all I knew that rhymed together, and they were horrible poems. But the fact is that of all the poetic devices, probably the easiest for us to learn, because my daughter, who's in kindergarten right now, part of her homework this month is to understand what words rhyme. And so I am a stickler when it comes to rhyming. I want to see it done well, and I want to see it done for a reason. So if your pattern changes, I'm going to look to why does that happen? So what I find really impressive about this poem is just that. The entire scope of the poem is an A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G scheme. We changed our rhyme on the last two couplets. And what's really cool about that is the bulk of the poem is all about these really, really vibrant images. It's about these things that make you want to look at them. You can easily visualize them. You want to paint them, just like you were saying, Phil. You know, I'm not a visual artist either. My sister is fantastic at it. But I'm really, really lucky if I can draw a straight line without a ruler. Not to brag, I did it the other day. But we have these really beautiful, vivid images in each line, and they're brief lines. They don't have to go into great detail to paint a beautiful picture. The little grains of sand and all this. And you think of the beaches and how many sands are on that and how uncountable the stars are. To me, that is a beautiful poem to write about, because you can never count all the grains of sand or all the stars in the sky. The atom that vibrates and make a man, you know, it speaks of what we are made of, but also how we come to be, the inception of life and even the process of life, where perhaps our atoms stop vibrating so much and our hearts eventually fail from it. The mother blue of Earth and the rest of Mars, the beautiful contrast of those two. Each and every single line is vibrant in his imagery. However, that last little couplet, really, it's all of this and infinitely more that fill the dreaming darkness at my core. That gives me a lot of pause. That gives me grief because as someone who tends to use poetry as an outlet for processing emotions, because frankly, I struggle with it. I think we all struggle with it, but I struggle with apathy. What I think is phenomenal about that is this speaks in something that I understand. It speaks of apathy. It speaks of depression. It speaks of the overwhelming darkness that can sometimes fill our lives. It doesn't mean that we don't live thinking about the beauty of life, about the vibrancy of it, of wanting to daydream about those moments that we're not sure that we're going to get to live through or ever experience. It speaks of the rainbows and the glory to feel separated from, because our life is a lot of blacks and grays and the occasional white specks. And so we went from this beautiful, beautiful painting to grayscale with a couplet. And to me, that makes this so incredibly powerful, not just for each line that holds a vibrant, vibrant painting, but also the reminder that sometimes those vibrant paintings are out of our reach, but we can still dream about them. It's an amazing piece.
Beautifully said. Robert, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. In that sentiment, like the last lines kind of accentuated the rest of the poem in the sense that it kind of made the room darker, but the TV brighter because of it, and type of thing. You know what I mean? That's a simple analogy I can think of what I'm trying to convey. But, you know, I like the rhyme through and through, and it was simplistic rhyme, but that didn't take away from the poem itself, in my opinion. I can agree that sometimes, you know, rhyme can seem forced, but here it seemed to fit kind of well, and in the sense that like that mother blue of Earth, the rust of Mars, the spread of eyes that paint a peacock's fan, you know, like how Feliciano mentioned the peacock's fan. It was like a really, really vivid image in my mind. Like I just saw it as it happened. And then the beetle's back as well. Like, you know, the phenomena of the color swirls and the changing and in nature, like if that was brilliant. Like I really thought this was beautiful and brilliant all the way through. And the ending really amplified the rest of the poem, and it kind of made you feel everything a little bit more because of it. So yeah, I think they sealed the deal on this one and did a great job.
Well said. Our next poem is Hypnagogia by Kiku. Suppose the rain is not sadness. That is the natural succession to a long drought. Too eager to reach for the umbrella, perhaps the sunset is not final crease of the day, but the night will continue to unfold from itself. An unfinished poem addressed to restless dawns. Tonight, I sit with my piano and we talk, it tells me, understands me, urges me to speak. Thoughts tangled in its coiled copper strings. I play an excerpt of the Notturno from an old Suzuki book. Sweet music wedged in between eclectic vinyl records. Its voice escapes like a thin whisper at my sleight of hand. The second F key sticks silently, an improv. Call it our musical interpretation. And suddenly, it all makes sense. End poem. Victoria, will you start the comments, please?
I would love to. so often in life, we look for finality. We look for the end. In fact, I am currently anxiously awaiting the rain that is supposed to be here for the fall. We've had way too many sunny days. But we often attribute emotions to things. You know, anger is not necessarily a negative emotion, but society looks upon it as a negative thing. We look at the end of the day as the sun setting. We look for those finalities. We want life to have certain rules that it abides by. But in doing so, we often restrict ourselves in so many ways. So instead of looking at a cloudy, rainy day, or in my case, a sunny, blue, something that is to be avoided as something that leaves us as melancholy and lamenting, we have the opportunity to see this as a reprieve. The rain gives life to the plants who have been thirsting for days and weeks and months, or perhaps even the breaking of a blue day could be the reprieve from plants that perhaps need to dry out a little bit so that they can breathe in the life and the light and grow and thrive, because you can't overwater a plant and it's just as bad as not watering it. Perhaps we don't always need to reach for that umbrella because we don't want to get those droplets on us, and instead take a moment to just kind of feel the washing off of that. You know, the day does not end. The ability to do things and get things done and be accomplished does not end when the sun sets, but more adventures can be had in the night. Good things can be had in the night. And though many things wind down with the dawning of the day, it does not necessarily mean. What I particularly liked about all of this, though, is actually the fact that those last few lines, his voice escapes like a thin whisper at the slide of my hand. The second F key sticks silently, an improv, call it our musical interpretation, and suddenly it all makes sense. I, fun fact, before I ever studied accounting in college, did 3 years as a double major for music and psychology. I wanted to be a music therapist because I find it fascinating the way that music interacts and affects creatures and life and even our healing process. Hospitals have found that if they play calming music in ICU wards, the body actually heals better and faster. Likewise, there's actually a species of snake that, because I love snakes, there's a species of snake that, depending on the type of music you play, a different snake will become dominant. And they show this by developing a ring around their body. To me, it's fascinating. But what's really cool is, being classically trained, one of the things I had to learn was music history. And I've got some really fun historical facts about varying pieces and works of music. But one of the things that we have perhaps lost in our modern day is that when you read a score, when you read your music, it tells you how loud you're supposed to be. It tells you the tempo. It tells you the key. It tells you the way that the notes are supposed to connect to each other to get to the essence of the piece. But once upon a time, it didn't look like that. It didn't have how loud or how quietly you're supposed to play. It didn't tell you if you're supposed to play a quarter note or an eighth of a note or a 16th note. It didn't tell you any of that. It just would kind of be an idea, and I just based the name, not the maestro. It could be the maestro, the guy with the wand. He would kind of help direct it and determine what it should sound like, but it was also up to the individual artist. So in an orchestra, having played the violin, we have a first chair, and the first chair of the first and second violins, even the violas and the basses and the cellos, they all have a first chair, and that first chair will actually lead the directionality of the bows and even the manner in which you play. So really, even though you had an orchestra or a symphony of many, many people, one seat directed that entire section. That one seat got to interpret the music with the help of the maestro. It was, or the conductor, that's what it is. But one seat. gave the interpretation. So what I really like about this is when I start thinking about music, we often want to stick to what we know. We want to stick to our documents, our scripts, our scores that have very specific, you will play a note here and you will play a note here and this one will be a flat and this one will be a sharp. This will be an augmented chord and this one will be a diminished chord. But in the end, true classical music didn't have any of that. It had improv. It had the ability to play without restriction and change based upon the person sitting in that first seat. It had the ability to have a new interpretation each time and not just be played in one specific way. And life is much like that. We want rules, but it doesn't have to be. And once upon a time, it wasn't.
I really like that. I did not know that about music, but I kind of feel that way about stories, because storytelling was originally mostly oral, and people would go from community to community. You know, there were the bards and the skalds who would go, and their livelihood was to tell stories and entertain and share information from community to community. And those stories would evolve depending on who the audience was. You know, you're going to tell it a little differently for the king than you would for the peasants, because you know, who they're going to cheer for in the story might be different. The way that you portray certain characters might change. And you can just improvise depending on your mood and kind of the feel for who your audience is. You change it. But now, with everything written, it's harder to adapt. And I find the audience is less adaptable. I do storytelling for young kids, and a lot of times I kind of tell the story without actually using the book, or I have felt stories, so I have pieces of like felt basically cut into images from the story, and then I'll tell the story using them as my props or with puppets. And if I stray from the book at all, the kids will be like, that's not the order that they did it in. And I'm like, you're getting the essence of the story, but we're going to make it work how it is. And partly that's my laziness if I didn't put all the animals in the right order. But you can tell the story in whatever order, and it still tells the same story. It's just like they encounter different animals at different times. But people are rigid now, and they want it exactly how it was told before. And there used to be that flexibility. So I like that in this poem, that she's going with that, where she has that that little change that makes her own personality influence things. Her own moment changes it. And I like that she uses sleight of hand, because sleight of hand I think of as trickery, like the thing that people, magicians do to make it seem like it's magic, but they're just moving things like up their sleeve or something. Sleight of hand, so for her movement of her hand in her music to be a sleight of hand, she's being like a little bit sneaky in changing the song to fit herself. It's kind of how I see that, and maybe that's just my complete lack of knowledge of music. But I like that, and I really loved the part about the night will continue to unfold from itself, because after calling the sunset the crease, it's not the final crease of the day. It will unfold, and then I'm kind of picturing like this 3D model of like you take the sunset and it's going over, and you think like it's looking like, you know, the flat earth kind of view of here's the day's all done, but no, there's still the other side of things. I really love the way that's put together with the final crease of the day and unfold, and the way that unfold is italicized to make you think about that. And then improv is also italicized because those are key moments in the poem that the poet wants you to pay attention to.
That was
Robert,
an amazing comment, Dave. Oh.
Thanks.
Well, I really quickly just wanted to say, I thought it was an amazing comment because I didn't even think about how in storytelling we are fairly rigid. However, just tonight I got, you know, my eldest is 5, so we're reading every night because we have a reading log. And she picked The Little Mermaid. And I, of course, am assuming like we just read Cinderella, and Cinderella was not the Grimm Brothers version of Cinderella with eyeballs being pecked out. And so I thought this would be the same. And it was, in fact, more along the lines of the Grimm fairy tales, except adjusted so that she didn't turn into sea foam. But it actually did have the whole, like, the sisters brought a knife to kill the prince, and she couldn't kill the prince. And so there was definitely a moment where I was fairly rigid of, like, this is not what I was expecting. Even though I know this story, it is not what I was expecting, given what I've experienced. So even in that moment, I empathize with what you were saying. Sorry, Robert, take it away.
No problem. I like the take on this because Ms. Frost pointed out that there's always a finality, you know, like we always try to give things an ending and say that's that, you know. Even people were so afraid of death that, you know, they started thinking of ways that we could either cheat death or that we can say that death is not the end and things like that. So, you know, that really created a divide in a lot of people. Like some people were like, oh, you know, when you die, it's just, that's it. It's just blackness and whatever. Some people are like, no, when you die, this happens. So I don't know what made me think of that, but the whole finality thing really rung true with me. And that, as you guys pointed out, I really like the sense that she says, suppose the rain is not the sadness, that it is the natural succession to a long drought. And damn, do I relate to that, because, you know, California droughts, it's crazy over here. We could use something. But this really struck in my mind. There was a beautiful chord struck, not be facetious, but she struck a great chord. And like sweet music wedged in between eclectic vinyl records, its voice escapes like a thin whisper at my sleight of hand, you know, as Faziana mentioned. I really appreciated the second F key stick silently and improv, you know, like, oh, well, you know, we'll just work with what we got. And I like that what you were saying about the conductor, allowing the symphony or orchestra, I should say, as you mentioned, was able to just be itself, to just be its own creature and roll with its own devices and just run with it, you know. And a lot of people nowadays, we're programmed basically to kind of fall in line. You know, there has to be structure, there has to be this, there has to be that, and creativity is out the window. And I like this type of poetry that says, no, it doesn't need to be. You know, we can still appreciate the structure, but we can also improve upon it with grace and letting the natural order take place. So I don't know, it just really inspired me and made me think of writing myself in a way. But yeah, like Faziana said.
The more we read, the more we want to write. I can't remember what author I was talking to. I think it was Eric Wilson, who's a children's author, and some kids asked him, if I want to be a writer, what do I do? And he said, read. It was like his very simple answer of like, read. Read a lot. Get ideas. But anyway, I get to talk to children's authors, and that's like the thing I geek out about. Victoria, will you please read Etchings?
Absolutely. And I will say, I have a tiny human being who is recovering from the same sinus infection. So I may have to leave after this one to give her medicine and get her back to bed. So just full warning. Okay, this is Etching by Gronwy. Scuttling across my years as a nimbus floating sky, hidden by a western moon, handmade by a rising sun, sniffs the scented frosted day, surprised awake by sharp light, fearful of a plague of thoughts from a storyteller brain, making daymares to break my bread, one hand clapping silently. I stand drunken in my tower with well-cracked skull and roomy eyes, knocked down by forgotten words spilling ink of red wine blood, writing, dancing, joking lines of jester tales told in laughing bells, rung by rattling sticks and stones on acid-etched window glass, seen through windows lit by stars, seeking facts and advice from Fatima's hand and bolted locks, opening salvation gates, bought and sold in written lamplight strapped on the wheel of life, turning with the windmill sails, deceptive and grinding bones, flour turned to rising dough baked into the bread of life, sandwiches made from souls swallowed with a tea time cup in melting landscape grass green with time under waning moon. Listening to the tolling curfew bell, dusk catches in the throat with prayers of hope abandoned here in the coffin's shroud. End poem.
Beautiful read and really intricate poem. Like, I felt like each line had things to unpack. Really great word choices too, like scuttling, the very first word, I really like, because it's not a typical word you would use to talk about traversing time, scuttling across my years. Now, I'm blanking, but I think scuttling, and I could be wrong, is like the way that a crab walks, that sideways kind of thing. So the idea of going sideways across your years, it's like it's not necessarily a linear thing, that you're kind of all over the place with it. But now I'm thinking scuttle is the bird in Little Mermaid. So I could just be lost in my own head. But either way, I like that unusual word choice. And then making daymares to break my bread, one hand clapping silently. I think daymares are not used enough, because there's this thing of, like, people tend to think of daydreams as only a positive thing. But, I mean, nightmares are not only when you're asleep. If, mind you, I am kind of mentally ill, so I might not be a good example, but daymares are a thing where your mind kind of goes places that you don't want it to go, and that's what you imagine. It's not always just daydreams. So I like that they use that word. From a storyteller brain in particular, because I think as storytellers, we tend to have wild imaginations. My dreams often don't include myself. I just make up stories in my subconscious. And maybe they have meanings about me, but mostly it's not. I'm not even a part of it. And I think storytellers tend to have a lot of anxiety, too, because not all of our stories are pleasant. Drunken in my tower with well-cracked skull and roomy eyes. Like, is this about me? feels like it. Some really beautiful wording here. Where is it? Sandwiches made from souls swallowed with a tea time cup. Like, that is an intense line right there. And then ending in the coffin shroud. There's a very dark beauty to this poem I find very intriguing. Robert, what were your thoughts?
Well, you know, I could be wrong, but you know, it's my interpretation. This could be told by like a ghost even, because like or the spirit of someone, you know, scuttling across my ears, you know, the nimbus, floating sky, you know. So I think of that, you know, something floating, or, you know, just floating on by and scuttling. Yeah, it could be like crab walk, as you were saying, but I think I may be wrong, because the whole thing that got me was the, sandwiches made from soul swallowed with a tea time cup. It sounds very ominous and like, deathly. And, the prayers of hope abandoned here in the coffin shroud. That last line too reiterates like what I was saying, like, well, my perspective. So I don't know. This is a very complex poem, as you were saying, and it has like its own story within each, like every two lines tells like a new story and adds upon the existing story. So, I mean, for me, I stand drunken in my tower with well-cracked skull and roomy eyes. That's another thing that could, ghosts get drunk, but maybe that's talking about like an aloofness or euphoria of sorts. Who knows? I don't know. I don't even know if I'm right, but the daymares too, like witnessing like, you know, visions or reminiscence of the past and things like that. So I don't know. Maybe it's just my warped mind, but yeah, either way, this poem did its job in making me think and making me like kind of really examine the wording and going a different route, you know. And if I am correct, I think that this is like, even if I'm not correct, this is a great poem. But if it is that way, I would say that's a hell of a bit of genius right there. So yeah, thanks for sharing this one, Gornly.
I like your interpretation. I think that works. When I look at the line in melting landscapes, I picture like Salvador Dali kind of art too. So there's a trippiness to it. That's just sinking in now, delayed reaction. Victoria, are you still with us?
I am. I wanted to make sure I got to comment on this one before I ran away. So I really love Master M's interpretation of this, because I think that there's a lot to it. And I think he's right. I have my own interpretation, though, that I think there are parts that also buoy his. So the first stanza, the first stanza, I think, is the final days of life, scuttling across my ears, so kind of hurriedly moving across your ears, as a nimbus floating sky. So the nimbus cloud is like that dark rain cloud. So we don't have a lot of brightness. It's kind of that dreary overcastness, hidden by a western moon, which is actually where the moon sets. So unlike the sun, which rises in the east, sets in the west. So western moon is also setting. So kind of coming to the end of the true day, handmade by a rising sun, sniffed the scented frosted day. To me, this is also a hint at winter, which in the seasonal depiction of life is also the moment of death, surprised awake by a sharp light. So someone's checking on them. Perhaps they're seeing a moment of heaven's gates. But it's this first stanza to me speaks a lot of and darkness, the daymares, the well-cracked skulls and roomy eyes kind of reminded me of like the corpse bride, like sorcerer guy. It just reminds me of him with like those deep sunken eyes, kind of his bones are frail and weary and bent over and unable to even sustain themselves. So I think this first stanza is kind of like the wrapping up of life. These are those last final moments. The darkness is setting in, the day is coming to an end. And even though we are getting to smell the beautiful crispness of a frosted day, we are also becoming more aware that our time on this earth is not really intended to thrive anymore. We aren't going into fields of green. We are standing drunken in a tower surrounded by skulls. I think the second stanza is more like the eulogy and the transitioning of the soul to the afterlife. Knocked down by forgotten words, spilling ink of red wine blood, writing, dancing, joking lines of jester tales told in laughing bells, rung by rattling sticks and stones on acid-etched window glass. The really cool thing about acid-etched windows or acid-etched glass, I got to do this when I was back in high school, was etch some glass. Now it's all rave for crafters, but I got to do it well before then, ahead of the time. Anyways, it's a process that you have to kind of be careful of. If you keep the acid on for too long, it will erode too much of the glass, and it won't leave kind of a smooth surface and rather sharp edges that you can cut yourself on, and it degrades the integrity of the glass. On the other hand, it's a permanent thing. Once you've etched glass with acid, it can't be undone. It is what it is and will forever be until that glass is broken. Glass is actually a liquid, so if it sits on itself in time, it starts to wave. But even that waving won't get rid of that etching. Even time cannot remove what has been set in glass, or perhaps what has been set in gravestone. And so to me, this speaks of the eulogy, the words that are coming from the heart, the beautiful, the painful, perhaps the words of people who are celebrating your demise, like Scrooge. There are people who dance and joke and speak so happily about you, but there's still those sadness of the bells that ring your final passing, sending you off into salvation's gate. The final stanza really reminds me of the body returning to the earth. So the bones ground into bone meal to feed the flour that can then be baked into a bread to grant life. It can be the souls of those who have passed. It can also be the weighing of your soul. And you kind of think of the Egyptian lore where the heart was weighed with a feather. What if this is another opportunity to see if your bread rises because it was whole and filling, or if your bread does not, then perhaps it sinks to the bottom of the lake of souls, and you will be sipped upon with the tea time. The melting landscape to me actually really reminded me of the actual coffin being placed into the ground, what that perspective might look like as you went down and you saw the grass turning into the white, turning into the dirt, with the white roots until finally even the roots are gone and you are just surrounded by the dark, black, brown, dank earth that eventually is piled on top of you. And so at that point, once everything else is gone and you are stuck looking up at this nimbus floating sky, this black, turbulent sky, that is when the curfew bell rings. Dusk catches in the throat. Death catches in the throat. And all prayers for hope are abandoned because there is no more time left because the coffin has shrouded all hopes. So to me, this is that end of life. And what you lose as you approach that end of life and the passing of it and the body and the hopes and the dreams. So stunning, stunning, right? Well deserving the front page pick that it got.
Wow. That was an amazing comment. I feel like I have like an entirely new appreciation for the poem after what both of you said. And yeah, just so much in there. Wow. You could dedicate a whole show or like a book to interpreting this. I mean, just the part you said about the etching the glass and how that stays forever, even as it, like, there's so many metaphors in here that I didn't even catch on first reading, that I feel like I have to read it over and over and over again, and grasp all of that. So thank you for your comments, both of you. It's wonderful to hear people's perspective on things. Let me see what I miss. Our next poem is by Blues Man. And if it will load Robert, I'm going to get you to read that one.
Okay.
My computer is being super slow. Can you perhaps grab it from the board? So I think our topic board should be the one at the very top of Late Night Poets. And
I got it.
On that board. Okay, awesome. The one by Blues Man.
Yeah. All right, let me post that. Blues Man. Okay. So now my computer. Okay, there it goes. Work of art by Blues Man. A well-beaten path most choose to tread, the sheep of humanity in conformity's bed. They live in illusion in the land of pretend, trapped in a box they cannot transcend. Cold iron shackles of free will they self-bind, harboring their freedom with guarded mind. In knowing oneself, always nurture your heart. By extending your aura, your life becomes art. Moral conscience guides the life that you lead. Forgoing all wants, only take what you need. Follow your dreams of heart, mind, and soul. In healthy esteem, you will always be whole. When cutting new paths, new vistas you'll view. Life's lessons are sojourns manifested by you. Though you'll stumble and fall as you go on your way, each day you will own when apart from the fray. Cherish this life that has grown from within, where your going is guided by where you have been. Be true to yourself, always follow your heart. As you're blazing new trails, your life becomes art. End poem.
Excellent read, thank you. I liked conformity's bed. Because there is like a comfort to a certain degree in conformity, and to just kind of like allow yourself to stay in that box and its cushiness, and just fit in and feel safe and tucked into that. So I really like the use of that. I know that bed was partly used because it would rhyme with tread, and but it just, I think that actually went together very nicely. Cold iron shackles of free will, they self-bind. I think the self-bind is really important there, because it's not that, you know, we are locked in necessarily by our circumstances, although sometimes we put ourselves in those circumstances. Sometimes we tie ourselves to circumstances we could have left from. So the self-binding there, I thought was really good. Where's the other part I want to talk about? I've lost my spot. I like the message at the end. Be true to yourself. Always follow your heart. If you're blazing new trails, your life becomes art. It's simple, but it's powerful as a way of life. You know, be yourself, and your art, your life will be beautiful if you are going with what matters to you and making your own path. So I like the message, and I thought it was put together in a nice kind of light way. We've had a lot of really heavy stuff tonight, and while this does have depth to it, it's a little bit lighter, and it's refreshing. I'd like to say goodnight to Victoria. She has left for the night to take care of her tiny human, I hope the little one gets well soon. Robert, what did you think of the poem?
Well, yeah, I think he touched on a lot of important aspects as far as being true to yourself. You know, a lot of people change with the tide. You know, the wind blows, they go a different direction. So where it is cool to have choice, it's also good to stand your ground at times. It's also good to kind of ground yourself and be a pillar, especially when, you know, trying to be swayed in one way or another. You really have to think and sit there and process what it is that you truly believe in. And he kind of, he really touched on that fact. Like when he says, they live in an illusion, in the land of pretend, trapped in a box, they cannot transcend. Like you put yourself in this situation, and you build a roof and you seal it like upon yourself, and you can't get out of it. Like you have to just use the door sometimes, and you know, or the window even. Like think outside the box. That's a weird way of, an interesting way of thinking about it. But yeah, like you know, you can't always give in to the conformity and go with the crowd and you know, they call the sheep or whatever it is. Be your own person. You know, stay unique. Stay yourself, and deliver your message as best as you can. And I think that he really did a good job in conveying that, even with the rhyme. You know, like he there were some areas where the rhyme, it was obvious, but it did not detract from the whole message of the poem. And that's very important, and especially this type of poem, because it's telling people to, like, it's basically liberate yourself, like, you know, free your mind. Don't be what people tell you to be. Don't follow you know, the same path as everyone else. Make your own path. And I really, really like that. Like, when cutting new paths, new vistas you'll view, life's lessons are sojourns manifested by you. You know, and you're not gonna be, it's not gonna be an easy journey. You're gonna stumble and fall, but you'll get there. And it's easier done when you take time to yourself. So wow, this is very inspiring and very thought provoking, and I really enjoyed his message.
That was a fantastic comment. I'm gonna do one of my poems. It's not totally on topic, but there's only one more in the contest. I'm going to save that for you to read. So let's do my strange one from about a year ago, because it's kind of about not quite fitting any side of myself. I can't even say my own title. Sorry. Monochopsis, but not so subtle. My laughter is too loud for the bookworms to whom I relate, but I shrink awkwardly in the presence of confident alphas. My blue hair and black nails scared my preppy classmate, but the punks and goths thought I was too lost in nostalgia. My formality destroys my cred on the street, but I'm not serious enough for the elite. That was before my brain broke, when at least I felt human when I spoke. Now I'm like an alien, not at home in my skin, wondering if there's still a person within. Standing in line, mentally rehearsing simple interaction, as if it's my first time with a debit transaction. Speak the truth, but it feels like a lie. Never home in any space I occupy. End poem.
Yeah, see, that's, I think we're spirit twins or something, because that's exactly how I feel a lot of the time. Like when you say, my formality destroys my credit on the street, but I'm not serious enough for the elite. You know, it's like people that know me, like if you were to look at me on the street and you'd be like, oh man, that guy looks mean, or I don't want to talk to that guy. People used to even talk across the street, you know, to avoid, you know, walking next to me for some reason. But when you speak to me, I'm not necessarily, you know, that evil of a person, but, The way that you said that, like, my formality destroys my cred on the street. It's like as if you're people feel like comfortable, like, yeah, you're kind of in the Goldilocks zone, to where you're easy to talk to, but you're not snobby, you know. And I like that. I really enjoyed that. And then that was before my brain broke, when at least I felt human when I spoke. I can relate indefinitely, because I feel like a lot of times that I'm only tapping into that former self, you know, the former what you would call intellect, I suppose. When I'm writing, you know, I feel dumb when I talk. That's just the way it is for me. I can't say what I want to say, and so I can really relate to this. Now I'm like an alien, not at home in my skin, wondering if there's still a person within. And I get that too, you know. I don't feel like I'm who I'm supposed to be. And yeah, this really hits really close to home. But I'm glad that you shared it, because I'm sure that there's many people that feel this way, and that's what we're here to do. You know, we're here to spread this type of message that, hey, man, you know, you may feel strange, but hey, someone else out there feels the same way. Someone else out there feels strange, or feels inadequate, or feels lonely or dark, or, you know, whatever it is. They feel rage. We're all human. And this is a fantastic, and the rhyme was great too. But this is a fantastic way of displaying that and conveying that, you know, that on a personal level, you know. So I thought it was great.
Thank you. Yeah, one of my therapists, because I've been through a few, was asking me if I ever write down, like, when I'm feeling kind of crazy. And I was like, oh, yeah, and I brought her my book of poems. And she was like, can I give this to my patients? And I'm like, sure. But it was just, like, the idea of, like, not feeling like you're the only person who has this kind of thought. And that's one of the great things about books and poetry and all kinds of things is, especially if you're someone who's isolated, getting to know other people's thoughts and perspective through stories that you read or poems is a way of knowing that, like, the way things happen in your head are okay. Like, it's okay not to always be okay. And people don't always know that, because most people hide their feelings like this, like, you know, when you're like, I wonder if I'm real. Like, that's generally not something people say out loud, but I have no filter, so I will. And then if anyone was secretly thinking it, they now know that I also do. So I think there is, you know, a good thing about being willing to share our unusual side sometimes in our writing.
Yes, indeed.
I've posted a poem by Daniel Deschino.
Ooh. Daniel E. All right. Did you want me to read it, or are you going to read it?
You, please.
Okay. There is no I in team, but there is a me, just one anagram possibility, by Daniel Deschino. I'm not the treasure at rainbow's end, but the focus of which the surrounding colors flow. Everyone marvels at prismatic radiance, but no one follows the radius, as the white light center is visible to those who only see with vision. I am a strobe light through time, not one frame of film. Look at me now. What do you see? A brushstroke on a daily painting in a lifelong, endless gallery. Abhor whispers in the wind and watch seagulls soar to discover the hidden path. Each blink, a picture of the carnival that is me. Multiple acts at once with the ringleader somewhere in my head. So hard to pay attention to just one performer, but the audience looks everywhere, and the multiple spotlights make a circle of shadows that surround me, each one a different view. Yet the whole of lights together keeps the me in the middle as just a black silhouette. So many different paths to climb mountains, so many different places to stop, give up, and turn back down. So easy to just stay at the bottom and walk around. And for those who make it to the summit and discover horizon sphere, standing tall on the foundation's peak, I am not the mountain. I am the tectonic plates deep below that created it. End poem.
Great read. And as always, a fantastic poem. I'm a big fan of Daniel Deschino. And he actually is filling in as my co-host on Thursdays while Dexter is on hiatus. So thank you for that, Daniel. I think this is a wonderful poem. I really liked the way that he describes life as the painting, a brushstroke on a daily painting. It's like the idea of adding just a little bit to the artwork every day, and then in the end, that painting is your life. So you've just added a little speck of what your life is with each experience. I think that's a beautiful metaphor. I found it interesting his spelling of soar when he says, and watch seagulls soar to discover the hidden path, because seagulls, when soaring, as in flying, would be S-O-A-R, I believe, and he wrote it as S-O-R-E, which I know that he knows the difference. So I think, actually, he's saying, like, they don't really want to discover, or they're painfully discovering the hidden path. They are suffering because of finding that hidden path, not just soaring, as in going down that path. Now, I could be wrong, because, you know, all of us make mistakes with homonyms. But Daniel is so clever that I kind of think that he's trying to do some kind of double meaning in that line. So, Dan, I know you listened to this. I want you to tell me later, was that intentional? I'm calling you out. I like that he's talking about all the different performers of the carnival being himself, and he's somewhere in there is the ringleader who's, like, telling everyone what their roles are, and then it all becomes, like, the show is him, and all of that aspect of it is him. They're all the real him, but he's showing up as just a black silhouette, because none of it really comes through when you're trying to be everything. If you're everything, then you are nothing. I am the tectonic plates deep below that created it. Not being the mountain that everyone sees, being the kind of behind-the-scenes issues that shape the world. It's just a very clever piece. Well done, Dan. Robert, how did you interpret it?
Well, yeah, I saw that too with the soar when I was reading. I was like, Dan seems too smart for that. So he will probably be humble enough to say that he's not. But from what I've known of him recently, because, you know, I'm meeting a lot of new people and everyone seems cool. And Dan is one of my new favorite people to read, because his writing is just so awesome. He's just a cool person in general. But yeah, like, I'm trying to find it. Let's see. And watch the seagull soar to discover the hidden path. Like, I think that it could also mean that they're not just suffering, but that they're weary. You know, they're sore. Their wings are sore from trying to discover the new path or the hidden path. And, you know, they're just doing their damnedest to get there. And he sets himself up as each act of the carnival. But he's all and nothing at the same time, just like almost like a shadow of himself in a chaotic environment, you know? He's just in the middle as a black silhouette. So even though you see him, you can make out something that may be him. It's not really him. You know, it's just his shell, his form that is there. And it's probably attest to, like, the darker days, you know, when you don't even feel like yourself. So many different paths to climb the mountains, so many different places to stop. I really like the part where he says, I am not the mountain, I am the tectonic plates deep below that created it, which means, you know, I'm not just the result of this that is here. I am the every event that got me here. I, you know, every decision, every tear, every, you know, everything that was shed to get to this place. I am all of these things that, and not just the result, you know. So I could really appreciate that and thought it was a bit of genius that he ended it that way. You know, so I thought it was very well done.
It is a fantastic ending. I know, the one thing is, like, when we were talking about him becoming my co-host, he was like, well, now I can't enter your contest. And I'm like, well, that's unacceptable because he always enters my contest, but I always love it. I'm like, maybe you can't win, but you're still writing to all my contests. This is mandatory. You can't quit on me now. Since we have 10 more minutes to kill because of my timing was slightly off, I'm doing another one of mine just to get that in there, and then we'll talk about next couple shows. Yes?
Oh, I was going to say, if you like, also after yours, if there's enough time, I have one about addiction that I wrote a long time ago.
Yes,
kind of
please.
This one, but yeah, let's go with that. I mean, with yours.
All right. Add that to the board. While you look it up, I'll just go through this one. The vocabulary of my being. The vocabulary of my faith came late. Monotheism was the only option presented. Age of Reason tried on atheist and agnostic. They almost fit, but never complemented my form. Eventually, humanism felt like couture. The vocabulary of my orientation was absent. Straight was the default, with no alternative. Hidden books revealed the G and the L, but bi was not identified until adulthood. Relief realizing I wasn't an alien anomaly. The vocabulary of mind's malady was unknown. I had no words to express turbulent thoughts, the shattering psyche undiagnosed, indescribable, symptoms no syllables could put shape to. The vocabulary of my being could have written a different story. Words matter. And poem.
Yeah, that is very true, that that ending, words matter. That's why they say before that, matter, like that's why witches call it spells or something. I forget how the quote goes, but yeah, the vocabulary of my faith came late. Monotheism was the only option presented. In that sense, when you're growing up, you basically have to take what's given, you know, and a lot of people don't really develop themselves, obviously, until later in their teen years when they start to rebel. And you'll be like, no, this is not what I want. This is not what I want. What you're saying is wrong. And that gets interpreted as, oh, that he, you know, you think you know it all. But they're really just trying to find themselves. So in that sense, where you said the age of reason tried on atheist and agnostic, you know, they almost fit me but never complemented my form. Even eventually humanism felt like culture. So, yeah, I'm with you on the whole humanism thing. I tend to lean towards atheism, but you know the humanity. I mean, we're all here, you know. And humanism seems like the go-to. Like, you know, that's what a lot more people should be thinking. But nope, as you can see in present day, that is not the case. And I don't know. I really like your whole, like, kind of like driving through of the spike, the vocabulary of the mind, the vocabulary of my orientation, the vocabulary of my being, you know, in each one is basically iterating like a piece of yourself. And I do like the word malady and turbulent. And, you know, those are two very strong words that are not used often. Turbulent more than malady, but malady is such a great word. So I'm glad that you included it in there. And, yeah, the vocabulary of my being could have written a different story, you know. And a lot of times we feel that we could have turned out differently if only we had made a different decision. And that is all too relatable. So, yeah, great poem. I'm glad you shared it.
Thank you. I've posted the link for yours if you'll share it with us.
Okay. I wrote this a long time ago for a contest called The Affliction of Addiction. Because when I am with you, pain melts away. Everything you do brightens my day. When we embrace, time stands still. Joy rules this face, emotions instill. Euphoric seduction, warming my soul. Your sweet corruption devours me whole. As time passes on, I notice a change. When you are gone, I feel so strange. Without you here, I'm walking blind, swallowed by fear and soulfully confined. Sadness consumes, taking its toll. Misery looms, I lose control. I need you now, more than ever. I do not know how to live with never. Just one more kiss, just one more chance. Don't deny me this chemical romance. You have been taken, and now I am lost. Hopeless and forsaken, paying the cost. Who would have known that my addiction would leave me alone in withering affliction? I have severed all ties, all bridges burnt, with all of the lies a harsh lesson learnt. With every bad decision, I now painfully lie in a cold, dark prison where I soon will die. And
wow. Wow. This is definitely very powerful. You know, the things that addicts go through, and at some point it seems like it could almost be an addiction to a person, to a relationship, but it also, like, you know, personifies addiction as, you know, you're desperate for that drug or that alcohol or whatever it is, and, you know, make bad choices due to it, and it ends up being isolating. You see that at the end, I have severed all ties, all bridges burnt with all of the lies, a harsh lesson learned. And so often that happens is addiction ends up alienating everyone in your life because, I mean, people end up stealing from their loved ones, and, you know, it becomes a problem in so many ways. And that harsh lesson of being apart from everyone, and then in the cold, dark prison, that can be a literal prison, or even if it's the prison of your mind, you can be lost in that. And I know a lot of people who've suffered with addiction, some of them, recovering and some not. And it's such a powerful topic that I think is important to talk about. So thank you for sharing this.
Thank you.
Yeah, wow. I'm, like, so caught up in, like, the whole thing that I have to look for specific pieces to cut out because I was just, like, thinking about the whole more than the specifics. I like the reference to the chemical romance because there is that kind of feeling where, you know, often drugs imitate those chemicals that you get from love and sex and all of those things, and it's that happy feeling instantly, instant gratification kind of thing, and it becomes a chemical romance for real. And then I think of the band. Blog Talk is telling me that we're out of time, so I'm sorry. Thank you so much, Robert, for hosting with me tonight and having such wonderful comments. Thank you, Victoria, for calling in. Thank you to everybody who wrote for my contests. I will judge some contests this weekend so I can make more. I'm maxed out on contests currently. But there will be new contests from me by the end of the weekend. Good night, everyone.
Thank you. Good night.